Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
And Alistair, you wanted us to I think, focus on four main issues today. Is that right? You were going to do Nadim Zahawi and his tax situation. You were going to do Boris Johnson and the chairman of the BBC. Then we were going to touch on Germany and Leopard tanks. And I'm speaking from Kigali in Rwanda. So you suggested maybe we should do a little bit on Africa towards the end.
There's a lot going on there, which you are well placed to talk about. But yeah, I think we have to start with your friend Nadim Zahawi, who we discussed last week, suggested that he might be in a little bit more trouble than the fairly tame media coverage at the time was suggesting. And I don't know if you've been able to see much of our media out there, but the coverage appears to be anything but tame now. And of course, we're speaking on Monday evening, not long after Rishi Sunak has asked his so-called independent, so-called ethics advisor, Laurie Magnus, to look into Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs. And I just wonder now whether waiting for Laurie Magnus will become the new waiting for Sue Gray.
Yes, well, presumably that's the hope, isn't it, of the government? Just to remind again, listeners, because it's fresh in our mind, but may not be fresh in everybody's mind. But one of the great delaying tactics during Boris Johnson's investigation over COVID was to initially say that they couldn't say anything until the Metropolitan Police had reported. Then they weren't going to say anything until Sue Gray reported. And then somehow the timing of Sue Gray's report interfered with the Metropolitan Police report. So that instead of an immediate resignation, you had this sort of 4-6 month delay going on, which I guess, is that what you think is going on here as well?
Yeah, I think both in relation to Zahawi, and we'll come on to the BBC chairman, Richard Sharp, and his relationship with Johnson, and of course with Sunak, because he's one of Sunak's closest friends. Sharp was his former boss. But the BBC have announced an internal inquiry into whether there was a conflict of interest related to Richard Sharp's appointment as chairman of the BBC. And Sunak has asked his ethics advisor to look into Zahawi's state of affairs. And you won't have heard, because I know you've been in meetings all day, you won't have heard your excellent former colleague, Dominic Grieve, on the radio this morning, who was making the point that this is all very well, but actually it's not difficult to establish the facts on this. And it's for Rishi Sunak just very quickly to establish the facts. And when Sunak says of Nadim Zahawi's tax affairs, he says that, you know, there are clearly questions to ask and questions to answer. I can't help thinking these are questions that should have been asked before he was appointed to be Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Again, to remind listeners of the scandal. The scandal is...
You love reminding listeners, don't you?
Take about the context. So Nadim Zahawi just paid the Inland Revenue millions of pounds, whatever, the 3-point-something million pounds on the basis...
Well, it could be more. We think it's more now.
Right. But at least 3-and-something million pounds on the basis of tax that he ought to have paid, capital gains tax, to do with a offshore company, founders shares. And he seems to have made this payment, is this right, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer or just before he became Chancellor of the Exchequer?
According to the absolute oracle on this subject, Dan Needle, great name, and he is the former tax lawyer who has been pursuing this. And it's really interesting. I tweeted today saying that this could be the first year when the journalist of the year is not a journalist, because this guy has really pursued this while most of the rest of the media have laid off. Nadim Zahawi threatened him with libel. Turns out that he's threatened him with libel over things that seem to be true, which I think of itself is a sackable offence, but there we are. We'll see whether that happens. I think the most important point within relation to HMRC is that the payment that he's made has included a sizable punishment, if you like, which he's had to pay because he didn't submit his forms as they should have been done. And one of the many interesting voices I've heard on this in the last 24 hours, a guy called Edward Troop, and he was on the radio yesterday. He used to work for HMRC in a very, very senior position. And I thought I knew everything about the honours system because I had the unfortunate task and I had to coordinate the damn things because I used to present them as the ridiculously in our system. It's the Prime Minister's spokesman who presents them. But I didn't know that honours, the list of people up for honours is sent to HMRC and they have a traffic light system of red, amber and green.
Goodness.
And one of the stories yesterday was in the Sun on Sunday, I think it was, that Zahawi was up for a knighthood and had been turned down for it. Now, all these, no pun intended, red lights are flashing all over the place. Now, it doesn't surprise me at all that Boris Johnson never asked any questions when he made him Chancellor. But given we were told that Sunak was bringing back grown-up politics, I wonder whether it isn't a little bit more odd that Sunak appears to have asked no questions about Zahawi's tax affairs either. So while he was Chancellor, boss of the HMRC, he was doing a deal with the HMRC, which included a punishment for non-declaration of tax. Now, my chaps in the Lido changing room, Rory, to a man, were absolutely spitting about this.
Your professional opinion, what do you think this means? So we're recording this, I think, on the 23rd of January. Nadim Zahawi is still chairman of the Conservative Party. Do you think that's going to be true in a week's time?
Well, they're obviously going to do the, you know, let's wait for Laurie Magnus. He's going to become the new Sue Gray. But I think a lot will depend on what happens at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. I think it's quite unfortunate for the government that the main pieces of legislation in the Commons this week are the Economic Crime Bill, which are all about, you know, tax avoidance and money laundering and Russian money in the economy. And I see David Davis is on manoeuvres on that one as well with another Labour ally. Last week he was working in hand in glove with Stella Creasy. This week it's Liam Byrne. I think it's very, very difficult for him. I don't see, and also it's doubly unfortunate for him that he's chairman of the Conservative Party, because that's one of those jobs where you have to go, you're meant to be out there the whole time sort of talking to the media, fronting up problems for the government.
What would be your political advice if you found yourself, obviously you wouldn't want to find yourself in this situation, but if you found yourself in the situation of advising Rishi Sunak, what would you be advising him to do at the moment?
Get the facts. And see, Sunak's made this very difficult for himself because the day he took office, he said that this would be a government. He was obviously disassociating himself as best he could without slagging them from Truss and Johnson. He said this would be a government guided by professionalism, integrity and accountability at every level. Well, professionalism, you don't stand up in the House of Commons as he did and say Nadim Zahawi has answered every question that he's answered all the questions when he clearly hasn't. You don't talk about professionalism when you send out your Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, yesterday to do the worst media round I've ever seen in my life, where my great friend and hero, Peter Stavanovich, who does some wonderful stuff on social media, he clipped together all the occasions in one interview with Sophie Ridge that James Cleverly said, I don't have the details on that. I'm sorry, I don't have any details. I'm sorry, I don't know about that. And then started to tell us the reason he didn't have the answers to the questions was because on Saturday he'd had a bit of a rest and he was shopping. This was so unprofessional, it was untrue. And then as for integrity and accountability, I think to most members of the public, accountability is about putting yourself up for questioning in Parliament and in the media. Nadim Zahawi's hiding away. And integrity, I think for most people, you've blown it. Once you start talking about offshore trusts, millions of pounds of tax that you clearly didn't want to pay, you're in trouble. So I think Sunak should work out where it's going to end and get there first. But he's already missed the boat, I think. Now, on Tuesday, the Committee on Standards in Public Life are doing a big report about my beloved Nolan principles: honesty, openness, objectivity, selfless, integrity, accountability, and leadership. And they make a big point, and this I suspect was written before any of this, but they make a big point about the importance of the example that is set by leaders, of what they tolerate and what they don't. So if a leader tolerates tax avoidance or tolerates bullying, Priti Patel, etc., then it does substantially and detrimentally affect the culture that you're supposed to be leading. So I think this is a problem for Sunak as well as for Zahawi.
Okay, which brings us on to the absolutely staggering case of Boris Johnson. And in some ways, because he's not Prime Minister, people are not focusing on just how outrageous and disgusting that is. So Boris Johnson, as we discussed in last week's podcast, found himself in some unbelievable financial problem. And he found himself in the humiliating position, it seems, of firstly confessing to the cabinet secretary, Simon Case, that he was running out of money, that he was in debt, that he was in financial trouble. And then somehow convincing a group of friends stroke donors, apparently it seems led by the man that he subsequently made the chairman of the BBC, Richard Sharp from Goldman Sachs, to pull together an £800,000 loan. Now, one of the things that I remember when I was joining the civil service is we had these developed vetting processes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was about whether you were in debt, because if you were facing £800,000 worth of debt and you had no viable source of income, which is what Boris Johnson seemed to be saying, I'm sorry, I'm bust, I can't get any money in, and I owe all this money to all these different people, you are in real danger because people don't really, sadly, give you money for nothing, and you are absolutely liable to influence and abuse. Since then, he's taken £1 million donation from an individual towards the Boris Johnson Foundation, whatever that is, and I'd like to know what the rules are and what he can actually spend that on. He's got, apparently, now use of a grace and favour house in London, led by his friend Lord Bamford, which is meant to be, according to the newspapers, and it was true, a £12 million townhouse that he now uses. But the most odd thing is that the cabinet secretary somehow did not think that it was necessary to declare that the prime minister had just availed himself this credit facility of £800,000. And why the cabinet secretary and the ethics advisor did not think this was a sort of flagrantly in the public interest to know that, I can't imagine.
I'm imagining now that there's a lawyer on my shoulder, but we know that the fish rots from the head. And I think he has had, Johnson's presence in Downing Street has had a deeply corrupting influence upon a lot of the people around him. I sent you earlier, or you probably didn't have time to listen to it, but you should have a listen. I sent you a clip of an interview on James O'Brien's show on LBC this morning, a Scottish London-based civil servant who phoned James's programme coincidentally, didn't know it was going to happen, but coincidentally on the day that Sunak and Javid finally made their move against Boris Johnson. And this guy phoned up James O'Brien to say, the country needs to wake up. We were becoming a corrupt country. He said in today's interview that as a result of that, he was suspended for 3 months pending an investigation to see whether he's in breach of his civil service contract. He was fired. But he said that he sent a clip of his interview, the first interview with James O'Brien, to Simon Case, and said, when is the senior civil service going to stand up for the standards that you're meant to uphold? And the guy was virtually in tears today. And James O'Brien said to him, you know, at least you can have a clear conscience. But he was a guy saying, we've got to wake up. This is full-scale corruption inside our government. And I think, you know, I've written a piece for The Independent, which I've just posted just before we started. And the point I'd make about the BBC is that they do have an extraordinarily good reputation all over the world. But I think they put it at risk when they don't cover their own scandals with the same vigour as perhaps they should, and they do others. And I think there has been a pattern in recent years because of all the political pressures from the Tories, because of the placemen going on, whether it's Richard Sharp, whether it's Robbie Gibb, there's a sort of fear inside the BBC about taking on these scandals. And if you go right through them, whether it was corruption in the Brexit, the law breaking with Brexit, Russian oligarchs and Russian money in the Tory party, the PPE scandals, the Johnson lies, which just weren't called out when they knew that he was lying, including in interviews with them. And the BBC kind of gets dragged, kicking and screaming, to these scandals. Now, fair play to them. On Saturday night, when the Sunday Times story broke about this one, the story you're talking about, the BBC covered it. They've been covering it. But I suspect they, too, now will be hiding behind the Richard Sharp has called for an inquiry. Let's wait for the inquiry.
One question. How was the Prime Minister in trouble to the tune of £800,000? So we know that this is somebody who was earning a lot of money. He was being paid, I think, £250,000 a year as a Daily Telegraph columnist when he was also an MP, in receipt of his MP's money. When he moved into Downing Street, he had a free London house, 10 Downing Street, a country house, Chequers. Why did he need £800,000? Who was he in debt to? Now, presumably some of this is to do with his divorces and his alimony payments, but presumably, fundamentally, he is profligate. He's not responsible with his money.
Well, you're asking the wrong person, Rory, because I've not spoken to Boris Johnson for some years. I think the last time I had a proper conversation with him was backstage at a Rolling Stones concert, where he continued to tell me about what a sort of figure of probity and honesty Andrew Gilligan was. Andrew Gilligan being the author of the report about Iraq that led to David Kelly's suicide and the public inquiry that led to the defenestration of the
We've got to do Iraq properly in detail sometime. We can't let you just drop that. We'll do that properly in detail sometime.
So I'm probably the last person to ask, but I think we know on the sort of what you said, profligate. But I also do think, I mean, this thing you said about, you know, I went through developed vetting and I can remember those questions. You know, you literally, and because I've got this sort of Scottish Presbyterian upbringing and all that, I've always been terrified of being in debt. I mean, apart from a mortgage, I can't stand the idea of being in debt. The idea of owing anybody £8, never mind £800,000, is just sort of out of my orbit.
And fundamentally, people have been saying on Twitter that Churchill was often in debt. And actually, that's true.
They weren't paid back then, were they?
Exactly. MPs were not paid. So he had to earn all his own money. They only started being paid after the war. And same with diplomats, actually. People who joined the Foreign Office had to have a private income. And the same with a lot of army officers had to have a private income in order to work in these professions. There's an amazing book on Churchill's finances, which I believe is called No More Champagne. But it's the most incredible account written by a lawyer who went through Churchill's account books. And the loans that Churchill took out from very, very unsuitable people who he then actually put in the cabinet during the war. Loans from newspaper proprietors, loans from industrialists, loans from fellow cabinet ministers. It's pretty shocking. Even more shocking what Lloyd George got up to with these horrible scandals in the 1920s.
Flogging his peerages.
But we're trying to emerge from that. And one of the most fundamental bits of the whole thing, which has been broken in this, which people keep forgetting about, is the transparency bit. It would have been less bad had the whole thing been declared at the time. What I can't understand is why the cabinet secretary thought it appropriate to keep it secret from the public.
Because I assume he's trying to stay in with his political master and doesn't want to speak truth to power. But speaking truth to power is his job. That is why he has a very large salary. And we've got this new one today, Rory. You probably haven't even heard about this one. The new health minister in the House of Lords apparently has huge interests in COVID testing. Some company that he's involved in. So that's now going to have to be referred to somebody or other. So there's been a breakdown of due diligence. The other thing, I don't like banging on about in the media the whole time, but I had a spat on Twitter with Nick Robinson yesterday. He told me to give it a break, which is the worst thing you can say to me when I'm on a run about something. You know, I kept going all day. But because I was saying, fair play, they covered the Richard Sarp story, but Zahawi was still sort of number 11 on the news website. This is when this should have been running for weeks. This has been going for days and weeks, this story, and they've been effectively ignoring it. And I was making the point. Nick said, you know, we covered the Zahawi story when he made his statement. But journalism isn't about covering what the powerful say. It's challenging and holding the powerful to account by investigating what they say.
I've been watching a lot of Al Jazeera because I've been abroad, and it certainly seems pretty impressive and punchy, and definitely their ticker tape is doing some amazing international stories. They had a story running yesterday, if people watch Al Jazeera television, on the SLAP process, which is the strategic lawsuit against public participation, which is often used in London to go against journalists reporting on scandals abroad. So if you are a Romanian doing a great story on corruption in the Azerbaijani government, these wealthy governments use very expensive lawyers to put an incredibly complex legal case called a slap on you. And it's been done to stop reporting on Serbia, stop reporting on Poland, stop reporting on Azerbaijan. But I was really taken by two things. Firstly, how courageous Al Jazeera often seems to be in surfacing stories that other people aren't, but also this bigger story of the way in which free reporting in Britain in general is being challenged by the courts, by expensive, wealthy people coming up with pernicious lawsuits because our libel laws are incredibly strong, much stronger than anyone else's.
And Nadeem Zahawi tried to use them against Dan Needle.
I believe the point is that in Britain, you have to prove entirely your allegation. The entire burden is on the defendant, whereas in other jurisdictions, the prosecutor has to prove it's not true.
We had some questions about this, which I was actually going to raise in the Q&A, but I'll raise it now. There's a campaign to get an amendment to a bill going through the Commons at the moment, where essentially they're cracking down on whistleblowers as well, that the public interest defense is not going to be as watertight as once it was. And we've also had situations where the Americans have refused to endorse some of the tougher changes that we've made in relation to libel in our country. And of course, you know, you look at the way that Carol Cadwalader, Guardian journalist, who I think is absolute heroine of journalism and campaigning, and again, who pretty much had to do a lot of it on her own. And I declare an interest here. My brother-in-law was part of her legal team. But her case with Aaron Banks was, she was the one who seemed to be on trial through the whole thing.
I think we're maybe just coming up towards our break. But after the break, we've got German leopard tanks and hopefully a bit of a chance to talk about Africa.
Good.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's podcast is sponsored by The New European. I've got to say, they've had some brilliant front covers down the years, but I do like this week's. It's a sort of classic police lineup. The headline is The Usually Suspect, and there are three people there, Mr. Sunak, Mr. Zahawi, and Mr. Johnson. And it would be very, very funny if it wasn't also desperately grim. But talking of great new European covers, they are repeating their offer of a copy of their book featuring the best of their front pages since the referendum of 2016, free to Rest is Politics listeners when they subscribe from just £1 a week, Rory.
So this week, for example, some beautiful photographs of the old 1950s steam night train service from Dover to Calais, where the train actually crossed the channel on the ferry, beautifully photographed in The New European.
So if you want to do something positive about the state of the media, you can subscribe to this award-winning newspaper, The New European, for just £1 a week. Or if you prefer to get the actual newspaper delivered to your door, just £2 a week. And they will send you a copy of the front covers book worth £15 for nought. These are the best prices you'll get anywhere for a New European subscription. So do something positive. Support quality, independent media. Sign up at www.theneweuropean.co.uk/trip. So welcome back to the second part of this episode of The Rest is Politics with me, Alistair Campbell.
And with me, Rory Stewart.
And Rory, did you get time properly to listen to my chat with Marina Litvinenko on Leading, the chart-topping new podcast presented by Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart?
Very much, and very, very topical, because we've got a number of things to talk about today which relate to Russia. Obviously, Russia-Ukraine and the dispute around Germany sending Leopard tanks. Russia-Africa, because there's been a lot of very strange Russian involvement recently in Mali, Burkina Faso. We talked a little bit before about Kosovo, where the EU and the Franco-German treaty is still trying to find some kind of accommodation between Serbia and Kosovo. And allegations now out that Russians have released videos of Serbian mercenaries being trained to go and fight in Ukraine. So all of that connects very, very well to the interview that you did, which focused on the horror, fundamentally, of the Putin regime.
Mm. And what I found remarkable about Marina was the extent to which she seemed sort of hopeful. She really does seem genuinely hopeful that Putin will eventually fall, and also that the husband, Alexander Litvinenko's killers, will eventually be brought to justice. I mean, I wonder if that's just hope that you have to hold on to in those circumstances, or whether she struck me as genuinely believing it.
I think in the end, her optimism is going to be validated. I mean, I think there's a sense in which Barack Obama is right, that the arc of justice moves in the right direction.
My current favorite podcast, apart from ours, is and our sister podcast, is Der Spiegel, Acht Milliarden, which is their foreign policy podcast. And their latest edition is all about the Wagner Group. The numbers of they've got these guys that they basically just take out of prison, tell them that if they allow themselves to be sort of chucked into the front line, if they come back alive, they won't have to go back to prison. And these are really, really, really powerful. And of course, I know you wanted to talk about Burkina Faso in part of your kind of African overview. And I, you know, there's this claim that as the Burkina Faso military government kicks out the French, which it's doing, that actually the Wagner Group are being invited in there as well. And there were Russian flags. There were Russian flags being waved at the protest against the French government in Burkina Faso.
Absolutely. So protests in Burkina Faso, military coups happen there, and the flags that are being waved are Russian flags and also the flags of Mali, where there's also been a military coup and where also the French have been kicked out and where also the Wagner Group has been invited in by the military government of Mali. So there's a very strong sense that what's happening in Mali and in Burkina Faso is that we're seeing military coups followed by the expulsion of French troops, followed by the inviting in of Russian mercenaries, which feels very much as though Russia is playing hard on the continent. And Sergei Lavrov,
he's out
in
there
South
now,
Africa,
yeah,
where the South Africans are looking at doing joint military exercises with Russia and China.
Russia and China are far more powerful in Africa than the debate in our world really reflects. And I think the other thing that I find fascinating about what's going on at the moment, I think this is the first year, and I can't remember how long, but normally there is a G7 country election. None of the kind of really, really, really major powers, as it were, have got an election this year. And I think the two most important elections in the world this year are Turkish presidential elections later this year and the Nigerian elections, which are happening later this month. And I don't think I've barely read a word about them.
Yeah, we've got to come back. Let's come back to that Nigerian subject, because I think it's an amazing one, and maybe give you a chance to talk about it a bit. But before we get on to that, one of the things you do know a lot about is Germany. And there's been an incredible back and forth around the supply of Leopard tanks. So the Ukrainians have been increasingly saying that the one thing that they're really missing now are tanks, because they have a limited window. The Russians are trying to mobilize another 500,000 people. And to really retake territory and cities, they're going to need tanks. And the British have started this debate to be complimentary towards Rishi Sunak, which we rarely are. Britain decided to send Challenger tanks, first country to send tanks. The Americans are sending armored fighting vehicles. But the thing that's really needed are not American tanks, which are incredibly complicated jet-propelled things that can barely be operated without a sort of massive supercomputer, but Leopard tanks, of which there are, I believe, nearly 2,000 currently in possession of other European armies that could be sent through to Ukraine, and Germany's holding off. So tell us a little bit about why they're holding off. Why do you think Germany's holding off?
Olaf Scholz is, if you go back almost a year now to the invasion, and Scholz made that famous speech that we both thought was a kind of massive seismic shift in German foreign policy when he talked about Zeitenwende. This is like a turning point. Since when, the word in German that keeps getting attached to him now is Zögern, which means to dither or to dilly-dally. And we're seeing this on the tanks. They've been asking, as you say, for some time. They had this meeting of defense ministers in Ramstein in Germany over the weekend. And still there is no definitive final decision. Now, I think the reason, if you boil it down, is the worry that if Germany were to do that, when everybody's saying this is the weaponry that is most important now for the next stage of this war against Russia, that in a sense that puts Germany right into it in a way that they don't feel they're right in it at the moment. And so I think Scholz's position is sort of that he'd like to do this, but he'd like to do it under cover of the Americans also doing it. And the Americans seem less keen.
Yeah, well, they have sent these amazing Stryker-armored vehicles. But since February, Timothy Garton-Ash, who you'll know well and was, you know, one of the leading voices with dissidents in East Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall, has written a really good series of pieces on Substack. Again, people who don't look at Substack, worth looking at, Timothy Garton-Ash. And he's pointed out that since February, there's been a pattern, which is that the Germans have consistently said with other types of munitions and supplies, we're not going to send it, we're not going to send it, we're not going to send it. And then eventually they end up sending it. So his prediction is they're going to end up sending the Leopards anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And presumably Scholz should get on with it now.
And of course, the other thing that happened over the weekend, you had this meeting between Scholz and Macron in Paris, where the entire German cabinet went to Paris.
Wow.
This was clearly, and dozens of other politicians, they had this big event, big speeches. And I think there is a sense that they maybe need to repair things because that relationship is not in good nick at all.
Why is that relationship not in good nick? Give us some examples.
Well, this is one. This is one where they don't seem to be in the same place on response to Ukraine and the military response. They don't seem to be in the same place on energy.
Or not in the same place on China. There was a big standoff on China.
No, exactly. We talked before about how Macron wanted to go with Scholz to see Xi Jinping, and Scholz said, no, I'm going on my own. They're not in the same place on future energy policy. They're not in the same place on the future of Europe. And I think the French diplomat I spoke to recently said that, you know, we used to sort of just take it for granted that the French and the Germans saw each other as each other's most important ally, particularly in Europe. But that is no longer automatically the case. So there's a bit of bridge building going on there. But meanwhile, this tanks thing, Scholz is coming under massive pressure. There was a report in one of the American papers yesterday that Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, after this Ramstein sort of impasse, really kind of laid into the new Boris Pistorius, the new defense minister. As kind of, you know, I think the Americans thought that getting rid of Lambrecht and getting Boris Pistorius in there would lead to them being able to make this change, but it still hasn't happened.
Well, so just a little update for readers who haven't been following the news from Ukraine. There's been essentially a pause over the Christmas period. The Ukrainians seem to be in a relatively strong position, and they are briefing out that they're ready to take a place called Kremina and Svatovye, and that would throw Russian forces 40 miles back if they were successful in doing that, close to where the invasion basically began in February. The real challenge is going to be whether, having taken Kherson, which was the big victory, you remember, a few weeks ago, whether they then cross over to the east side of the Dnipro River. So what happened, you'll remember, is that the Russian troops withdrew from Kherson east of that river, and the question is whether they then push on to try to break Russia's road and rail links down to Crimea. Meanwhile, Russia is rebuilding its key bridge to Crimea. It's trying to mobilize 500,000 troops, and there's a lot of talk in Russia about a spring offensive against Ukraine. So I suppose this tank conversation is the Ukrainians saying, it's not going to be very long before Putin is going to be mobilizing hundreds of thousands of people, and he's going to try to mount a spring offensive where he's going to try to push them all the way back to Kiev.
Which is why they want these tanks.
And they want to move now to push the Russians back to their starting position before that happens.
No, we're into an absolute key phase, no doubt about that. I think Timothy Garton-Ash is right that Scholz will eventually get there, but you're sensing something a bit desperate in the way the Ukrainians are talking about this, that they sort of feel they need this support now.
I mean, we should return to that. Meanwhile, we've touched a little bit on Africa. I'm talking to you from Kigali in Rwanda, and I came briefly through Addis Ababa on my way through. So yeah. Ethiopia, which we discussed a few weeks ago, there has been the beginnings of a peace agreement. And the Americans announced yesterday that the Eritrean forces were finally withdrawing from northern Ethiopia. But at the same time, Somalia, the depth of the drought now going into its fifth year, is pushing over 10 million people now into extreme starvation. And at the same time, Al-Shabaab just mounted another attack in Mogadishu last week. There have been counterattacks by the US military that have been striking Shabaab militants. That's now spreading into Kenya, where there's now a lot of conflict. And much of this conflict around the Horn of Africa, but also in the Sahel, so that whole belt that takes you right the way across from the west coast to the east coast of Africa, the bottom of the Sahara Desert, is increasingly driven by climate change and desertification and conflicts between nomadic groups and farming groups and increasingly terrorists and Islamic State militants, which is where the French got involved in Mali and Burkina Faso, and where the Wagner group, as we just said, now involved, but often fighting in a very brutal way about resources. Which brings us a little bit to the country which is really in the heart of this, which is Nigeria. So Nigeria, in context, 1 in 10 children born in the world will be born in Nigeria by 2050. And by 2030, within 7 years, the majority of the extreme poor in the world will be in Nigeria. Nigeria is the country the second most affected in the world now by extreme flooding. It's a country with an enormous GDP off the back of its oil, so you know, over $500 billion a year, and yet suffering from the most extreme problems of every sort, from Islamic State operations and insurgency in the north through to extreme poverty and flood events, and an election coming. So tell us a little bit about the election coming in February.
It's a sort of strange two-stage process, not entirely like the French system, but you kind of do have to whittle a few. I think there's about 18 candidates, but there's only three that really have any serious chance of making it. The outgoing president, Muhammadu Buhari, he has to go because they have a strict two-term limit. And the candidate for his party, the All Progressives Congress, is a guy called Bolo Tinubu. The two main challengers are a guy called Abubakar, Atiku Abubakar, the People's Democratic Party. Now, they're both pretty old. I think they're 69. One of them's in his 70s. The favorite at the moment is a guy called Peter Obi, who's a mere stripling at 61. And he's actually the Labour Party, but he's even wealthier than Nadeem Zahawi. I mean, he is like, you know, and all three of them are very, very wealthy. They've variously got all sorts of allegations hanging around their heads about, with Tinubu, there was stuff about him being involved in the drug trade, and he did some sort of deal with the authorities to get out of that. Abubakar, embezzlement. Peter Obi, he was in the Pandora Papers in relation to tax avoidance stuff.
And his campaign chief's just been done for money laundering. Bolan Tinubu, who's the Lagos governor, we talk about British politics being bad. He had to pay $41.8 million in a lawsuit on tax evasion to settle it. And then in the 1990s, he had to pay a $460,000 settlement on heroin trafficking.
I know.
Abubakar, the second candidate you mentioned, I think his wife carried $40 million in cash into the United States, which the US Senate exposed in a report.
And I read a piece in Foreign Policy magazine, and they said that when you define the strategy, like Peter Obi is at least sort of talking about, you know, trying to do something a bit different. And he's got the backing of Obasanjo, by the way, the former
He's a good guy. I mean, or at least I've always been very impressed by him.
Yeah, and also he's the African Union mediator in Ethiopia and Tigray, isn't he?
Yeah, no, Obasanjo is a really well-respected figure in Africa and one of the few Nigerian presidents that I think emerged with credit and has played a really important part in peace negotiations.
Also. Is he a distinguished, Roy? Do you think we can give him
I would definitely say he's distinguished. He's not the youngest man in the world.
No, he's getting old. But the other two, their strategy does appear to be based around taking some of this money, millions and millions and millions of which they have.
Hundreds of millions,
And giving it to voters.
So to put political context on Nigeria, obviously Nigeria, enormous country, vast, rapidly growing population, a population where I believe 84% of voters are under 35, although that's not unusual. Mozambique, 50% of people in Mozambique are under 15. Obviously, when we talk about, you know, we've talked about Japan and the way in which its population is slowing down and the way in which Britain's population will really only go up with immigration. But Africa is the big exception to that story. It's the one part of the world where population is still growing very dramatically. So Nigeria finds itself in very, very significant problems, particularly in the northeast of the country, where there's been a combination of a Boko Haram insurgency. People will remember famously young girls being kidnapped, but also the spillover from this whole conflict in the Sahel region, terrible problems on climate change, which means that there are millions of people receiving humanitarian assistance. I think nearly $3 billion of humanitarian assistance this year going to the northeast Nigeria. But unfortunately, the nature of Nigeria is that there are millions of other people displaced up and down the country with flooding events, climate events, but it has the most extraordinary natural resources. It has an incredibly entrepreneurial, dynamic population. It's one of the most exciting places to visit if everybody wants to go on holiday. Incredible cuisine, music, culture, and energy. I mean, anybody goes to Lagos, it's like getting an electric bolt.
Right. You're ready with your chin there. You talked about music. Name me a great Nigerian musician.
I can't do that. I'm rubbish on music in general. I can barely name a great Scottish musician.
I'm going to give you a great Scottish musician because I've just been listening to the new album of Duncan Chisholm, the great Scottish fiddler, called Black Cullen, and it's absolutely brilliant.
To step back just as we wrap, the World Bank's now put out its projections for 2023. It looks like we're now going into the third worst economic conditions globally that we've had in four decades, apart from the financial crisis and COVID. Developed countries barely growing. Africa certainly not growing enough to keep up with its population growth, and a horrible combination of inflation, high interest rates, meaning that there's no investment going into Africa. People are struggling to service their debt, much of that towards China, which we've discussed again. Chinese foreign minister just finished a big tour. Egypt, when we come back to North Africa, Egypt inflation now at 22%. The Chinese have put $59 billion into trying to build a new city on the edge of Cairo. Tunisia, which we discussed again, really struggling. I think something like 14% of people turned out for their elections and now demonstrations against Tunisian president. So let's watch Africa, I think, in the weeks ahead.
And just maybe that was quite dispiriting, but let's end on something really dispiriting. Obasanjo's report, he estimated that 600,000 people were killed in this two-year Tigray war in Ethiopia.
Ooh, 600,000.
Yeah. Which is way more than Ukraine, which gets so much focus. And it's way more than the total that you got that were lost in 5 years of civil war in Colombia.
And that's both us not paying attention, and it's also the Ethiopian government basically shutting out journalists very, very effectively. So the reporting didn't get through.
The Nobel Prize winning Prime Minister thereof.
Nobel Prize winning Prime Minister. Dangerous thing. Mm. If you're ever offered a Nobel Prize, Alistair, perhaps turn it down.
Don't know about that.
Okay, on that, we will wrap.
All the best. See you soon.
Bye-bye.